From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. The Senate approved an $838 billion economic stimulus package, and now negotiators in Congress are working to narrow out the differences between the Senate and House versions of the bill. Can Democrats and Republicans finally come together? Plus, Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner rolled out his proposal for the remaining bank bailout funds, but Wall Street was not impressed. And President Obama is crisscrossing the country to drum up support for the stimulus bill. But how are Americans responding? Here to help break down these political developments are Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She is also an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. And Ron Christie, CEO of Christie Strategies. He was also a special assistant to former President George W. Bush. Ron, Donna, nice to have you.
Hey, Tony.
Good afternoon,
Tony. Another week has passed without a stimulus plan in place, but at least we may be closer to one than we were a week ago. Senate voting yesterday to approve an $838 billion plan that lawmakers are now trying to narrow into a workable agreement between the Senate and the House versions. So, Donna, they're close and yet so far apart. The latest word is that they've cut it now to just under $790 billion. That's a $40 billion drop overall, but they're still not home free.
Well, as you well know, and Ron is also a veteran of Capitol Hill, the key thing right now is reconciliation. They have to reconcile two vastly different bills in terms of what's stimulus versus what's tax credits or tax cuts. I think what you'll hear later as this process continues is that the House will insist that some of the money for a school reconstruction be put back in. The Senate will insist that the tax credits that they have provided to homeowners and car buyers be retained. And at the end of the day, we will have a compromise. It will not be a perfect bill, but it will be a piece of legislation that will help invest in America's future, to save and create over 3 million jobs and help struggling homeowners.
That price tag, by the way, for the school construction is $16 billion. Well, Ron, you know, save for three Republican senators who backed the package, the vote on the bill so far has been quite partisan. And the senators who joined the Democrats, Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins, and Arlen Specter, are catching a great deal of heat from their partisan GOP colleagues. Can this partisan gap be closed?
Well, I think the partisan gap can be closed, Tony, but I think what led to the gap and this void in the first place was the inability of the Republicans in the House of Representatives and also in the Senate to a great deal to have any impact on the process. Particularly in the House, the Speaker decided that she was going to pass a stimulus package, and she was not that interested in reaching out to Republicans. We had a 40-year wish list, if you will, of some pork projects that were included in the bill. I think the three senators that you mentioned, Snowe, Collins, and Specter, are catching a lot of grief because I think if the Republicans had held firm, they would have had a better position to negotiate not only with their colleagues in the Senate, but with the president to try to really bring down the cost of the stimulus package. I'm all in favor, and many conservatives are all in favor of stimulating the economy and using the government to prime the pump. The question that many people have, and I have, is, how can you demonstrate to me that if you spend this amount of money, that it's going to create a certain amount of jobs? I think there's a certain level of vagueness, and I think that we hear a lot of promises that if we get this bill passed, that we're going to have all these new jobs. I want to see the specifics. I don't want to see the taxpayers get ripped off once again.
Well, what about the states? Donna, the governors are struggling to balance their budgets, and they want more spending. Even GOP governors like Arnold Schwarzenegger in California and Florida's Charlie Crist. Should lawmakers be placing more focus on what the states' needs are as part of this?
You know, when I mentioned 15 million, perhaps I should have said that all of these numbers are still under review. But let me say two things. One, the Republicans have not offered any alternative, no vision. When they sat on three committees during the House deliberations, they offered amendments. They offered amendments on the floor. It was more the same that got us into this mess in the first place, fiscal irresponsibility that led this president to inherit a soaring deficit as well as a recession. Governor Schwarzenegger, Governor Crist, and many other governors are facing a huge budget shortfall. As you well know, state budgets must be reconciled before the end of their fiscal year. These governors are requesting the money because they're having to make some tough decisions as it relates to education, health care for the poor, and they need help from Washington. Banks are not lending. They're having a hard time selling their bonds, municipal bonds and state bonds. So this is a critical piece of legislation at a time when over 20,000 people are losing their jobs each and every day.
Now, you and Ron have both articulated the various positions of the of your respective parties quite well, and it's perhaps because there is a disagreement there that the president took his case directly to the people. He held a news his first primetime news conference on Monday night.
Last month, our economy lost 598,000 jobs, which is nearly the equivalent of losing every single job in the state of Maine. And if there's anyone out there who still doesn't believe this constitutes a full-blown crisis, I suggest speaking to one of the millions of Americans whose lives have been turned upside down because they don't know where their next paycheck is coming from. And that is why the single most important part of this economic recovery and reinvestment plan is the fact that it will save or create up to 4 million jobs, because that's what America needs most right now.
Now, Ryan, according to polls by the Pew Research Center and others, 51% of Americans do support the stimulus. That's still a majority. However, that's down 6% from January. So is the public waffling on this?
I don't think the public's waffling. I think the more the public hears about this so-called stimulus bill, the more reasons they have to be skeptical. We just heard the president say a moment ago that his plan was going to save or create 4 million jobs. Give me a clear and coherent explanation how the government is going to create or save 4 million jobs. Jobs are created in the public sector. The government is not in the business of creating jobs. It's just a fact. And the other thing that I find fault with, and I think that it's indicative in the polls, is that the Congressional Budget Office and the Committee on Joint Taxation up on Capitol Hill both have said they cannot point to where a single job would be identified. I am all in favor of spending money and putting good money after good causes, but the president needs to do a far better job of articulating exactly how spending $1 here, $1 there will add up to a job being created or saved.
Well, Donna, go ahead, Donna.
It's easy for me as someone who knows how the government works. Ron, and you know as well, when a state receives federal grant money for particular construction projects, they normally go to the private sector to bid. So these jobs, 75% of the jobs that will be created, whether it's infrastructure or even some of the school construction money, will be bidded out at the state and local level. So 75% will be directed toward the private sector. That's why the United States Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers are supporting this bill. They are not your traditional liberal supporters. This is a very critical moment. People are broke, busted, and disgusted. Disgusted with Washington, D.C., disgusted with the politics of the past that has got us to this brink. And what they want from President Obama is to lead. That's why he's in Springfield, Virginia. He's going to Peoria. And that's why he must go out there, sell his plan, sell it to the American people so they know help is on the way.
What about the issue of the devil being in the details? And I'm thinking now particularly about Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, whose proposal for the remaining $350 billion in bank bailout funds, known as TARP, sort of fell short. Wall Street did not respond well to the plan, and the criticism of it was that it simply was not clear enough. So the question, and I'll direct this to you, Donna, briefly, and then let Ron respond, should it have been more precise, or would that have simply provided more opportunity for attacks on the plan before it could have been put in place?
Tony, I'm about to submit my resume to the Obama administration because I don't think these people understand just how difficult this issue is. The banks, some of these banks should be allowed to fail. They are making stupid decisions with our taxpayers' money. And yesterday when I saw Secretary Geithner speak, I sat there and I said, oh, my God, bring out the peanuts, but that'll give me salmonella. He offered nothing. We need specifics. We need to know we can no longer throw good money after bad.
Well, that's the point I think that you're making, Ryan. And to follow that up, on the Hill just today, the heads of eight of the top banks are facing their critics and making their case for more cash. But is this political theater? Do you expect something substantive to happen? Or are you still looking for those details that you're not getting?
I'm looking for the details I'm not getting. And see, I knew we could make a fiscal conservative, maybe even a Republican out of Donna yet.
But I don't know about that.
I don't want to push my luck. Look, my friend had it exactly right. I thought Geithner's really performance yesterday was atrocious. The American people need and expect and demand clarity and specificity from their leaders. And I think, starting with Secretary Paulson, candidly, I didn't think that we had it with the original TARP. And with Secretary Geithner, we don't have it now. I think if you'd put Donna and I in a room together for about an hour, we would have had a lot more specificity and details than the Treasury Secretary did. This is exactly what the American people, when they voted, said that they wanted a new change. We don't need more of the same, of the unclear nature of this TARP money. I thought it was atrocious, and I think we're going to see more political theater until they get their act together over there at the Treasury Department.
I've got less than 30 seconds for you, Donna, to respond to this, but this would seem to be the time that the President of the United States should step forward and lead in this regard. And he's attempting to do that, but the question is, how successfully is he doing it?
I think he's doing a remarkable job. He's been in the office less than a month. He is faced with, as I mentioned, one of the worst economic crises in the generation. He wants to reach out to the Republicans. He has invited them to cocktail hour every Wednesday. You know, perhaps I should stir up a hurricane, you know, that drink that we have down in New Orleans. If we give them a little liquor, maybe they'll move a little quicker.
Donna, thank you very much. Ron, thank you as well.
Pleasure as always. I can't top that.
No, you can't. That was Democratic strategist Donna Brazile. She is an author and a nationally syndicated columnist. Also, we were joined by Ron Christie. He is the CEO of Christie Strategies. He is also a former special assistant to President George W. Bush. They both joined us from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. Who says bloggers don't get any respect? Monday night's primetime presidential press conference was a history-making moment for online journalists. Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, and he joins me now. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tony.
Listen, so tell us about this big moment for political blogging.
Right. Well, President Obama held his first full-scale press conference earlier this week, and he invited blogger Sam Stein of the Huffington Post to ask a question. You know, it's the first time a blogger has been called upon at such a session, and Stein asked the president whether or not he'd support an investigation of the Bush administration's Department of Justice. Now, the Huffington Post, we should say, is a left-leaning progressive news and opinion site, which also supported the Obama campaign. But the White House made another digital era leap this week. They live-blogged the president's town hall meeting in Fort Myers, Florida. So when visitors went to that website, they got a real-time written update about the event. But the White House doesn't allow for user comments, so there was a level of interaction that was limited. But, you know, still
it's a step, maybe not a big step, but a step nonetheless.
Exactly.
All right. In a minute, we're going to talk to three of our regular bloggers. But what topics are getting into attention in the black blogosphere this week?
Well, this ongoing and developing saga between singers Chris Brown and Rihanna. The president's proposed stimulus package is getting kicked around online as well. This from the blog Political Season. He writes, "Half of America is very wary of the bailout, and the other half loathes it, and nobody understands the logic going into it. Is it just me, or would it have made a whole lot more sense for there to have been some public disclosure so that people understood the urgency and the emergency involved?" And this from the blog Cobb. "Like the woman who was pregnant when she voted for Obama because she thought he'd change America's healthcare system in time for her baby, a lot of people are going to be disappointed to find that the stimulus plan is not going to be as broad and timely as the economy will be wiping out jobs."
And after today's developments, they're probably going to be even more confused in terms of what's about
exactly
to happen. What can people find out on our website this week, Jeffrey?
Well, we've got two recent in-studio performances, one from Maisha, another one from Asha. They're both female singers who go by one name.
And they're both good, too.
Yeah, very good, yeah. Very good. So great interviews, great music, and it's all at nprnewsandviews.org.
Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Bennett is the digital producer for News and Notes, joining me here in the studios of NPR West. And now on to our bloggers roundtable. President Obama rolls out his version of faith-based initiatives, and the NAACP turns 100 years old. With us, we have writer Amani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report, former L.A. Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross. He blogs over at Three Brothers and a Sister and hosts The Kevin Ross Show on Blog Talk Radio, and Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. Hello, everybody.
Hello, Tony.
Hello.
Hey, Tony.
Nice to have you. Let's start with President Obama's new faith-based initiative. Actually, it isn't new at all. It's an extension of the controversial program begun under the Bush administration, and it grapples with the issue of separation of church and state. So, Kevin, in black communities, that line is often blurred. And with a black president, what effect can we expect from him with regard to faith-based policy?
I think the issue that Barack is going to have, our president, is one really about jobs. I mean, when you look at whether we're talking about the NAACP or we're talking about just this whole stimulus package, so much of what black folks are looking at right now is, look, I can't meet my mortgage. And while the woman who was in Fort Myers was saying, Barack, I need you to hook me up with a kitchen, you know, the fact remains that people aren't tithing. So these churches are seeing dwindling numbers in their church pews. They're not able to do their programming. But one of the issues that Bush had was this whole notion of who can the church hire and still maintain their integrity from a standpoint of if you're someone who believes in gay marriage and you want to work for a church, can you get that job? So I think those are going to be some of the issues that he's going to be grappling with, but I think it's really going to be dealing with this economy and how to reconcile it.
Let me bring Imani in, but before I do, Kevin, you said something that actually generated quite a bit of blogger reaction on our show, and that is you referred to the president as Barack. Before you respond, some people feel that that is an inappropriate way to respond to him as a president. Now, you're entitled to say whatever you want, but I wanted to bring it to your attention.
And you know, I caught that. And you know what else I caught? What? I caught Michelle doing the same thing. As I'm saying Michelle as in First Lady Michelle Obama. When she was speaking before a group of individuals, she said, and you know, Barack and I. And then this last time that she spoke, she referred to him as President Obama. And so you even have the first family
that's grappling with this.
That's going through this transition because we have been so used to calling him that. It's just like when I refer to George Bush, but no one necessarily caught that. And I think that's one of the issues, especially amongst black folks, that we have become so hypersensitive to the area of, did people refer to Bill Clinton by Bill or Slick? You know, what do they call him? Slick Willie? And they were all these different names. And he's the first black president. And you know how Clinton is. And so I don't want us to get so caught up in, well, he's our president, so we've got to be on our best behavior. I think that it's important to respect the office. But I did notice that. And I know exactly what you're talking about.
I just felt compelled to point that out.
Sure.
You know, Imani, I'm going to get us back on point about this faith-based initiative, unless you have a comment also about whether or not to refer to the president in that way. Part of that is because the president, I think, has presented himself as an everyman and someone who people should feel comfortable with relating to. But there is a line, perhaps, that should not be crossed, and we'll have to decide what that line is. Imani, what do you say about this faith-based initiative? Different from Bush's? Are you expecting something more from him because he is black and because of what he has said about his own faith?
Well, it seems like it's the same, but it's a little different in that these faith-based programs that are going to receive federal funds, they can't use discriminatory policies towards the folks who are receiving or benefiting from their programs, the folks who they end up hiring. So Obama seems to be, President Obama seems to be following the same ideas.
There you go.
But it's good that we address it. Finish your point, Imani.
Yeah, so President Obama seems to be following on the same path of President Bush in that the program is going to continue. However, he doesn't want, if, of course, any organization that's receiving federal funds, they can't use discriminatory practices, which, you know, seems like it's a fair thing to do. The question, I think, is how would the government enforce it? What kind of policies will be in place to make sure that religious organizations that receive these federal funds don't use discriminatory practices? Of course, if you have an organization or a church that doesn't support homosexuality, and then you have a homosexual who applies for a position in one of these organizations, you know, who's gonna make sure that these churches don't discriminate? So that's the bigger question.
And that is a very interesting point. And maybe one of the answers to that, Sean, will lie in the person who has been put in charge to lead that office. His name is Joshua Du Bois. I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, a 26-year-old Pentecostal minister. Do you have those kinds of concerns, the kind that Imani just mentioned?
Well, just quickly, Tony, I do have to mention a comment that my mom left on my blog relating to President Obama and whether we should call him by first name. She said, "I know my mother really well, too, but I didn't call her by her first name." So I had to put that out there. But okay. I think that okay. What we're seeing with President Obama with the stimulus package, what we've seen throughout his kind of presidency so far is he's walking a line. He's walking a line with this faith-based initiative between people who are strongly in support of separation of church and state, as well as those who are the faith-based group that Bush brought into office. So I do have some concerns as far as the hiring practices, because I don't believe that anyone receiving federal dollars should have the right to discriminate. But again, I think the thing to watch here is going to be how does President Obama straddle that fence between groups who don't generally agree on anything, and you wouldn't assume that a Democratic president is going to push a faith-based initiative because most of his Democratic counterparts were against it. So that's kind of the key here, is how will he straddle that fence?
One more thing on this before we move to another topic, Kevin, and that's this. To follow Sean's
That's Mr. Point, Ross to you, Tony.
Yes, Mr. Ross.
And I'll just say, Sean, from day one, I always called my mama, Mama. But if I had been calling her Barbara, and then all of a sudden she was like, from this point on, you're going to call me Mama, I may slip into a certain vernacular before I make that transition. So it's this whole point about Barack's name, the president's name. When Kanye West said George Bush doesn't like black people, he didn't say President Bush. And we knew exactly what he was saying. It wasn't
He didn't say George either, Kevin. Right.
What did he say?
He didn't say George.
When
you put the last name
in
there,
president,
that,
you say,
that gives that a little bit.
But wait, what did Kanye say? Didn't he say George Bush doesn't like black people?
Well, we don't want to go back there.
The only reason why I say I'm making the point, and because I saw the comments and I appreciate them, was that when we talk about the president as the position, and when we talk about what's going on in the blogosphere as it pertains to even this faith-based area, we're really talking about individuals on the ground and how are they going to benefit from all of his policies, whether it's Josh Du Bois saying, okay, this is how we're going to handle this, and we're going to take it by a case-by-case basis. What are we doing with the stimulus package? Right now, it doesn't matter what you call them. Folks are hurting and they need jobs. And if we're not able to address that on a level that people can relate to, they're going to be calling them more than just what we're referring to right now.
Let's move on to another topic that people perhaps are not talking about as much as they should, given the seriousness and the impact of this devastation on the black community. Last week, I don't know if any of the three of you know this, Black AIDS Awareness Day came and went. It happened on February the 7th, and it made very few ripples in the media world, but AIDS still continues to be widespread in the African-American community. Now, Imani, we know that AIDS is nothing new, and yet I have the sense, and I wonder if you do, and I'll ask all three of you, a sense that while there is awareness of AIDS in the black community, there doesn't appear to be a great discussion about it.
That may be because, of course, like you said, it's nothing new. The media is, of course, focused on the economy right now. And so that may be why the whole topic is overlooked. Of course, AIDS is still devastating in terms of, you know, the black community. According to the most recent numbers, there were more than 56,000 newly infected cases. And of those, 45% of those were black. That was in 2006. So it still is a condition, a disease that is ravishing the black community. The question becomes, how can we on a day-to-day basis perhaps continue the discussion, get ourselves talking about it, and then doing things to help preventing the disease? It certainly is not going away. And there definitely needs more attention from the media in general. But, you know, right now we're all focused on the economy. People are struggling. People are hungry. And so when you have those two things going on, that's why some issues get overlooked. And
Absolutely.
There are still other issues like education
Absolutely.
And other things that are important to us as well. So.
I would imagine, though, that going back to the whole point of the faith-based initiative, the church in the black community has been one of the places where traditionally community issues, political issues have been addressed. But because in the black church, its opposition to homosexuality, does that have an impact on the ability to get the word out and to mobilize people, do you think, Kevin?
Well, I will say this. I think that when you look at the black church, by and large, it's a place of worship and for you to really deal with your own spirituality from a standpoint of your higher power, whatever you want to call it. But it's also a business. And when you look at the business model that we're seeing in a lot of churches, they themselves are struggling. And so the last thing you want to do is do something that's going to offset your ability to continue to make the business thrive. And the reality is, as African Americans, we are very conservative. We're very much Republican in the sense of our politics, especially as it relates to the church. And so when you don't have a venue that really embraces the different lifestyles, and then you have the black media, which is also struggling financially, those are the forums where you would have these discussions. And right now, I just don't see that being at the top of the agenda.
What's your take, Imani?
Yeah, I would agree.
Can I say real quick, Tony, this is Sean.
Sean.
I wrote an article for Dallas Morning News on this particular subject that actually posted in the paper on Saturday and had no idea that was Black AIDS Awareness Day. And it just happened to coincide. And what I did was challenge the church and challenge the African-American community to start talking about this, because when we look at who's suffering the worst, it's us. And I think our stars, our community leaders are much more comfortable with talking about AIDS and HIV in Africa because it's far away and it seems like a big problem, but we are tentative and afraid to agree to address the situation here in the United States, because, you know, African-American women are 23 times more likely to be victim to this disease than
sure.
their white counterparts.
Well,
so
shouldn't this be coming? Should this not be coming from the first black president of the United States? And should not his a faith-based initiative be a part of the vanguard to get that word out?
See, I would say that where it came from in terms of Sean is exactly right. Sean is a blogger who has a show on Blog Talk Radio like me, like I'm doing a show tonight. We're going to be talking about these issues. You know, I wrote on the blog Three Brothers and a Sister what the NAACP needs to do in terms of, we've got these 100 years, but they're not doing anything. They're not speaking out. So when you have people like bloggers and people who are doing internet radio, they are becoming the voice of where the discussions need to go. Because, you know, let's just say Radio 1, for instance, right now, they've lost 18 stations. When you look at black newspapers, when you see Tribune getting ready to go bankrupt and you see Sirius XM radio getting ready to file for bankruptcy, you know that these black media outlets are dying on the vine, and it's going to take individuals like Sean and Dallas South and Armani and myself and others to keep those conversations going.
Armani, I'm going to let you have the last word on this. We've got about 30 seconds or so. Do you agree with Kevin?
Well, I mean, we're at a time now where we are now empowered to have conversations about what's important to us. And so with this topic of HIV, you know, it is ravishing the black community. It's and like was just mentioned, black women are being infected at a much higher rate because for whatever reason, black men aren't protecting themselves. Of course, it's on both people to protect themselves. But it's up to each person now. I mean, the mainstream media is having challenges. The media in general is having challenges. So we can't completely rely on the media. However, we do need to continue these conversations. And I think that's kind of the power in this conversation, too, is that now we're talking about this issue.
Absolutely.
We're raising awareness to this issue.
Absolutely.
And we need to keep having these conversations.
And unfortunately, our show is one of those that's going away also after March the 20th.
Indeed.
And we won't be able to continue
right.
to have this kind of thing. I appreciate, gentlemen, all of you coming on. We've been talking with Sean Williams, who publishes the blog Dallas South. He was at Cake Mix Recording Studio in Dallas, Texas. Writer Imani Channel, who blogs at My Urban Report. He joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. Also, former Los Angeles Superior Court Judge Kevin Ross, who blogs at Three Brothers and a Sister. He was with me here in our NPR West studios. And of course, you can find links to their blogs and to ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. And the conversation does not stop there. Our online series, Speak Your Mind, gives you a chance to sound off on the issues that you care about. To find out how, go to our blog, nprnewsandviews.org, and click on Speak Your Mind. Thanks, gentlemen. Next on News and Notes, Rihanna and Chris Brown missed the Grammys but made even bigger headlines. NPR's Allison Samuels will be here with the latest. I'm Tony Cox, and this is News and Notes. With me now is NPR's Allison Samuels, who has been following the drama of R&B and hip-hop singers Chris Brown and Rihanna. Hey, Allison.
Hi, Tony.
So, what's up?
Chris Brown's squeaky clean image may be tarnished forever after the violent altercation that allegedly happened between him and his girlfriend, Rihanna. The story really keeps developing. But here to help us with the latest is media consultant Marvette Brito. Hey, Marvette.
Hi.
How you doing?
Really good, really good.
Well, listen, tell us a little bit about what you know about what happened with these two last Saturday night.
Well, this is the best example of these two pop icons really being grossly misrepresented in every way. We don't know from the horse's mouth exactly what went on. So we're hearing a lot of allegations, and there's a lot of, you know, accusations being thrown about. What we do know is that they both missed a very, instrumental, high-profile night in their lives, which is obviously the Oscars of music, the Grammys. We know they weren't there. We know there was an altercation. We know that Chris was arrested. Beyond that, I think we really don't know what happened, what sparked it, what propelled it. We're all really grasping at straws and waiting to be told what really transpired.
Well, now, what have you heard? Because they have Rihanna's grandmother saying that she's doing okay. Have you heard anything about how Rihanna's actually doing? She's not in the hospital, but is she actually, you know, out and about? Or what have you heard about that?
You know, no one really knows. That's the thing. No one has seen her. And this guessing game is really, again, when I talk about the misrepresentation, someone on Rihanna's team, on Chris's team, need to diffuse all of this negative press that's swirling. You know, he was an all-American, wholesome pop idol. She was a pop princess, and they both are headline news in a negative way. So we don't really know what's going on. We're hearing that, you know, Jay-Z is getting involved.
Right. Well, let me ask you this, Marvette. What are some of the worst rumors? I mean, what have you heard that upset you more, you know, the most?
Mm-hmm. I think what I've heard that's upset me the most is, you know, the pimp slap in the New York Post today. I mean, you know, just the level of the words that they're using to describe something that clearly transpired between the two people who we haven't heard from has really been a bit unsettling to hear. Many people.
But when the police have to get involved, when you have to be taken to the hospital, obviously, you know, she was hurt. I mean,
something transpired. Or, you know, it's also, you know, the heat of the moment, the passion. She was probably alone, and certainly something happened between them, but we just don't know to what degree. You know, it could have been a slap. It could have been, we have no idea. But whatever it was enough to send her to the hospital. It could have been a bite, like we're hearing. You know, we really don't know. I would imagine that, you know, the more we hear, but I don't think it's as brutal as it's being made out to be.
Well, let me ask you this. In instances like this, you know, with celebrities, sometimes they're very hesitant to press charges. Do you think if there is any chance that she might do that if it was a situation where he hurt her?
She won't press charges. I'm absolutely sure that she won't press charges for two reasons. A, she's not going to want to, you know, go to court over and over again with someone she was clearly, you know, in a relationship with for well over a year. So I think the passionate heat of the moment and maybe the anger of the moment drove her to do that, but post, you know, now that it's all over, her representatives will sit down with her and they'll both want this to go away as quickly and painlessly as possible.
That's a good point and a good segue. How do they repair their images? How does Chris repair his image in particular? I mean, Rihanna's the victim seemingly at this point, allegedly. How does Chris Brown?
Well, Chris Brown, we need to hear from Chris Brown. We need to hear his side of the story. I mean, you know, to emerge and to keep going after such, I mean, abuse is really something that we just don't tend to tolerate, particularly, you know, domestic abuse. It's something that, you know, many people are faced with every day in this country and beyond this country. So I think that he needs to speak. We need to hear sincerity and humility from him. You know, and what I think this will do is now we have two of the biggest advocates for domestic violence, for domestic abuse. And I think that is a good thing. That'll be the you know, redeeming quality from all of this that will be helpful, and maybe his lyrics will change a little bit. You know, we won't just see him say, I'm sorry, and, you know, he not be mindful of this mishap. But in order for him to ever rebound from this, I'm seeing radio stations saying they're no longer playing his music. I mean, this could be a really detrimental blow to someone who had a really, really bright future.
Okay. Thank you so much, Marvette. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Marvette Brito is an entertainment and corporate brand strategist. She runs the Brito Agency. She spoke with us from her office in New York. Ugly incidents like these can be an opportunity to have an honest conversation about domestic violence. So how do you start that conversation? And what kinds of therapy are effective? Here to help with these questions is psychologist and attorney Paris Fennert-Williams. She specializes in marriage, family therapy, and domestic violence. Welcome, Paris.
Thank you. Thank you so very much for having me on.
First of all, these two are not married, so can we really call this domestic violence? Is this the correct term?
Well, usually we only refer to it as domestic violence when two individuals are living in the same home together and that is their primary residence. Other than that, we would ordinarily refer to it as assault and battery.
Okay. Looking at Chris Brown, he's this really squeaky clean, he had the squeaky clean image anyway, as a great entertainer. Young teenage girls loved him. What do parents now say, particularly to their young girls, about this incident?
Well, I think that this is a very good example, and we discuss it very extensively in our book, Single Wisdom. I think that what we have our obligation to say to both our men and our women is how to some guidelines and boundaries that they need to establish for themselves. There is a right that you have when you're dating somebody. You know, you have a right to refuse a date. You have a right to set boundaries and guidelines as to how you want to, your body wants to be touched. And you have a right to determine how you're going to be talked to. And you have a right to separate from a person and to leave the relationship alone. I think that mothers and fathers at this point need to educate their children, be it boys and girls, as to what their rights are so that they can preserve their self-image, their self-esteem, and be as productive in this world as possible.
Now, Brown said that he and his mother were beaten by a stepdad. What kind of impact does that have on a child, particularly a male child?
I think that whether it's a male child or a female child, that one thing that we have to keep in mind and to make it very basic is that none of us can do anything in life unless we have already seen it, been taught how to do it, or have experienced it through our five senses. The impact of what he has experienced is definitely a direct relationship to what he can do today. None of us can do anything unless we have already seen it. So many of us are growing up learning how to relate to people in an abusive and assaultive way because that is what we have seen. And so it's very consistent that what he has experienced in his adolescence and his childhood, and that impression starts around the age of 7. What we have experienced now is what he is demonstrating.
Well, that's a good question because I guess the question now is what kind of therapy is available, particularly for someone so young? I mean, he's a very young man. I think it's sometimes hard to get guys like that to go into therapy. What do you suggest for that?
Well, it's very difficult to get men into therapy under any circumstances. But the type of therapy that would be most effective with him at this point or with anyone who is abusing is what we call insight therapy, where a person where you would help them gain the insight to their behavior and why they behave the way that they do. And then the anger management so that he can learn the triggers, what causes him to become angry to the point that he is abusive. Now, I think it's also very important that we state, especially for the African-American community, that females are just as abusive, are abusing their male partners in an increasing degree, and that it's not just our men in our families and our communities that are being abusive. Females are being abusive in an increasing rate, and not at the degree of men currently, but
right.
It has certainly increased over the years.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. That was psychologist Paris Fennert-Williams. She specializes in marriage, family therapy, and domestic violence. She joined us from her office in Detroit.
Two 200 years ago, the man known as the Great Emancipator, Abraham Lincoln, was born. In honor of his birth, a special performance of The Lonesome Train is being given at New York's famed Riverside Church. It's an audio portrait of the slain president's final journey by rail through the byways and backwaters of America to his final resting place. The musical tribute originally premiered in 1942 and was composed by activist and musician Earl Robinson. It has not been performed in its entirety for 50 years. Maurice Perez is from the Aaron Copland School of Music at Queens College in New York. He'll be conducting the performance at Riverside Church. I asked him about the history of this special musical tribute.
They carried the news from Washington that Abraham Lincoln's time had come.
Earl, the composer Earl Robinson, called it a cantata, or a folk ballad. It tells the story of Lincoln's being on this train, his body being on this train and going from town to town, from whistle stop to whistle stop, and in a musical fashion, and it's a rather remarkable piece.
You became friends with the composer, Earl Robinson. Why was The Lonesome Train so important to him in his body of work, which included the folk ballad, Joe Hill?
Oh, well, he was always interested in writing works that would stimulate people, instill in people the sense of brotherhood. And this is 1944, where the war has just begun, the Second World War. And Earl and Millard Lampel, who was the writer of the text, got together and they thought, let's do something about Lincoln and that the fact that this body traveled all over the country and people of all sorts came to honor him. Because that was a way of talking about brotherhood and about freedom. So they cast this piece, and it took off. It became fairly overnight a fairly popular piece, and it was quickly done at the Hollywood Bowl with a big orchestra and such. And it was also recorded twice. So it's gone to sleep, but we're bringing it back.
The slaves were free, the war was won. But the fight for freedom had just begun.
One of the scenes that that caught my ear was the scene in the church when Lincoln is at the back and people are they're talking about him. Describe that for our listeners.
Well, we did it for the first time at the Riverside Church, which is where we're going to be doing this performance, on the very 200th birthday of Lincoln's birth. Yeah, and so the important thing is that we had never heard this preacher. And Earl had this insight that wherever Lincoln went, wherever the body was brought, people thought they saw him on the edge of the train platform. They saw him in the back of this old Baptist church where the black gospel preacher was singing, and people were responding to him. He's talking about there were not slaves anymore, and no more whips, and no more bad people to hurt us. And later on in the piece, they say that he's part of a square dance. Didn't we see Lincoln out there dancing with one of the prettiest girls? But coming back to the gospel preacher, last night was the first time that any of the choir, we had 220 people, and the orchestra of 60 or 70, and Ruby Dee standing there, and my two colleagues here, and he started to do this gospel thing, and the choir responded. It's an art form. I mean, it's an American art form. And Earl was clever enough to incorporate this thing into this wonderful story of American musicians who honored Lincoln.
You may bury me in the East. You may bury me in the West. But I'll hear that trumpet sound in the morning.
Award-winning actress Ruby Dee is narrator for The Lonesome Train.
I like working with an orchestra. I like the drama of mixing the media, you know, the drama of the prose and the rhythms music imposes on the story and the whole dynamic of the interplay between words and music.
Have you had rehearsals, and what have the rehearsals been like?
Oh, it's very much like the human voice becoming another instrument in the orchestra. Mr. Perez, who's the conductor, he recognizes the excitement of the drama in terms of contrast and excitement.
You know, final thing I want to ask you is this. You know, Abraham Lincoln was known as the great emancipator, mm-hmm. and the tributes to him musically and in film, this is just another example of it. Now we have a new president who has patterned himself in some ways after Abraham Lincoln. Do you think that there is a connection that people who are going to see the program will be able to make with our new president in resurrecting the image, shall we say, of Abraham Lincoln?
Oh, yes, because I do believe that ideas live, and they live through the ages, and they live through the pages. And to be impressed when you're so young by the spirit of such a man as Abraham Lincoln and all the books and analysis of his life and his work, we need examples, we need patterns, and these good people become ladders leading us to the better part of ourselves. And that's what I think Lincoln is to Obama.
Friends, we got a new land. Ain't no riding boss with no whip. Don't have no backbiter. Liars can't go. Cheaters can't go.
That was actress Ruby Dee, who will narrate The Lonesome Train at Riverside Church tomorrow. We also heard from Maurice Perez from the Aaron Copland School of Music at Queens College in New York. He'll be conducting the performance. Music was performed by balladeer Michael Mark and banjo player Eric Weisberg. They joined us from our NPR studios in New York. That's our show for today. Glad you could join us. To listen to the show or subscribe to the podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org. To join the conversation or sign up for the newsletter, visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. News and Notes was created by NPR News and the African American Public Radio Consortium. Tomorrow, some argue that the financial crisis swept President Obama into the White House. As he takes his pitch to the people, public support is waffling. We'll take a closer look at the economic heavy lifting ahead for this administration.